Sometimes in Buddhism, there is a distinction made between two kinds of meditation. When the distinction is made, there's the forms of meditation that involve mindfulness or vipassana, insight. And then there's the forms of meditation that involve concentration or samadhi. And sometimes a lot is made. These are two different meditation practices. And sometimes people say, no, no, they're not distinct meditation practices, but there are two different aspects or two different factors or two different qualities or aspects of meditation in general. And so for the people who want to bring them together, they'll say that both mindfulness and insight and concentration work together, support each other, and both of them are developed in the course of a single meditation practice. Sometimes they're considered separate meditations, sometimes lumped together more holistically. And when we look at these two general aspects of meditation, the insight aspect and the concentration aspect, somewhat roughly, it might be interesting to distinguish between the kind of meditation that focuses on our objective experience and the kind of meditation that focuses on our subjective experience, where insight practice focuses more on noticing or paying attention to the objective aspect of our experience, and concentration practice focuses a little more on the subjective aspect of our experience. So insight practice in looking at the objects of experience, you notice your breath. Your breath is an object of attention. You notice details of your breath. You'll hear a sound. The sound is an object. And so you're aware of the object, the sound. There's a lot of things you pay attention to. You can learn about the nature of the objects of the world. You can learn about the nature of the world itself if you pay attention to it carefully. The world is an object of attention you can take in and investigate. Our possessions, our relationships to other people, are the whole external world, but also you can have an objective relationship to what's going on inside. When you notice, for example, that you have an itch, that's the itch is the object, and your attention is paying attention to that object. If you notice you have a feeling, let me tell you, you're angry, then you notice the anger, and the anger becomes the object. And so you study the anger, get to know the anger, you penetrate the anger. The anger is the object. So it focuses more on the objective aspect of experience. Samadhi practices focus more on the subjective aspect, the nature of the world, the nature of what we can see and touch and hear and all that, is not really that important for concentration practice. What's important for concentration practice is how you shift and change subjectively as you do the meditation practice. So the insight practice, you're trying to have deep insight into the nature of things. In concentration practice, you're trying to having a deep transformation of the subjective state that you're in when you meditate, or when you are. And so there's these two different differences. And the two differences, object and subject, in a sense, fall into the very basic kind of dichotomy or distinction that's even built into our language, how we speak. If you take second, third, fourth grade class, I didn't pay attention, so I don't know what grade it was in. But somewhere in there, they teach you about the elements of a sentence, and there's a subject and the object. And it's kind of built into our language. And then there's various attempts in some spiritual circles to somehow heal or bridge or do away with the divide between the object and the subject, objective and subjective. And sometimes non-dualistic schools of meditation are looking to kind of overcome the dualism, the separation between subject and object. So they collapse, they become one. However, the subject-object distinction, which is pretty basic to human experience, is an important starting place. We always start where we're at. You don't want to leap over, how your mind is almost wired to experience the world too quickly. Eventually, in deep meditation or deep spirituality, some of that subject-object kind of distinction falls away. But I think for ordinary people, it's quite a valid and important distinction to be made. And so sometimes when people do insight meditation, they really focus a lot on penetrating the nature of the objects, it said. So you say that you have a physical pain, then to really understand that pain in a whole new way, it's possible to be have the attention kind of be reactive to the pain or trying to repulsed by the pain, kept at a distance. It's possible to have a lot of ideas and opinions about the pain, a lot of emotions and fears, fears or angers and different things can interfere with your ability to see the pain directly. And with insight meditation, you're trying to see through all that, all those veils of concepts and ideas and feelings, reactivity, so you can see the nature of the pain directly for itself. And many meditators say they discover that pain is a very different animal. If you can get really down there through the filters and veils that kind of stand between us and the pain and experience it very, very simply and directly and immediately. Sometimes people will report that it no longer is experienced as pain, but it becomes maybe intense sensation or vibration. Sometimes you realize how much of the nature of the so-called pain, the suffering part of the pain, is partly a creation of the mind, not just a physical phenomena, but sometimes has to do with fear or aversion or contraction around it. So with deep insight, you start seeing the nature of these things. With deep insight, you might see the nature of your conceptualization of the world. Concepts, ideas, are objects of attention as well. And you see the idea arises, for example, of my possession. This is mine. So, you know, that the notion of my possession is something that we use in our society. We have legal rights to your possessions in certain kind of ways. But that possessions are, you know, you can penetrate the nature of this concept of possessiveness and see how much it's a creation of the mind. And in seeing it as a creation of mind, you can start having a lighter relationship to this idea of this is mine. So maybe I did this last week. I did it recently, regularly enough, this idea that, you know, you come in here to sit, and you sit on a cushion, but then you have to leave and go to the bathroom, and you come back, and someone is sitting in your place on your cushion that you took from the shelf over there. Oh, my place. That person took my place and my cushion. And it's enough to get quite upset and angry. But then when you leave at the end, you put the cushion neatly back up there. And then you walk away, and the idea that this was my place and my cushion vanishes from your mind. The possessiveness of my place, my cushion, is a creation of the mind. It's a construct of the mind. And it has no inherent objective reality apart from what the mind has created and the situations here. And so it's a very important insight, because then you kind of begin loosening kind of the grip around mind, and you can hold things much more lightly. So certainly your place here you maybe hold lightly, but you hold your shoes as lightly. You know, your shoes don't care who they go home with, but you do, right? You know, those are my shoes. I used to wear Birkenstocks, and back when people wore them a lot, and I once came to a sitting group in Palo Alto, and there was a three-way Birkenstock switch. And I got the better Birkenstocks in the deal. Newer and everything. I don't know what the person was thinking, but anyway, three-way. And we never found out who one of the parties was, and I was left with these nice new shoes. And anyway, the idea of my shoes, you know, is also kind of light. So then I had these brand new Birkenstocks, and after a couple of months of that, it became clear no one's going to claim them, so now it's mine. Mine. And if someone came along and switched it with old Birkenstocks, then, oh no, my new shoes are gone. So the part of the function of mindfulness or insight is to start seeing through some of the kind of concepts and ideas we tend to grip onto. And by doing that, end up being quite stressful, being stressed or have a lot of suffering. Ideas of who I am, you know, all kinds of things I am, is also, you know, you can see through that. Who are you really? It's one of the great questions for any meditation practice. Who am I? And you start seeing all the different ways you kind of, all the different things you assign, all the things you claim is this is who I am. In deep insight meditation, you see those things don't really withstand scrutiny. They begin falling apart or falling off. And then you're left with the question, who am I? But rather than being oppressed by that, most people, when they get really deep into in meditation, find themselves lighter and lighter and freer, the less they hold on to as being, this is who I am. It's kind of a paradox. The freer you become, the less you hold on to as I am. Whereas many people think, I have to be someone, I have to hold on to something, a concept, you know, I'm the best, you know, whatever. They found that in studies that at schools, that when children take tests, you know, these experiments with kids, and one group of kids does a test, and they grade them, and they tell the kids, you guys are really smart. That's one control group. And the other control group, they say something like, oh, you guys really worked hard. And then they give them, both groups, a second test. Who do you think does the best? The smart one. They're both equally smart, both groups. No. The ones who are told, you worked hard. They do better in the second test. The ones who are told they're smart feel kind of entitled. They feel like they kind of like get along. And the idea that you have to make work and try hard is kind of like not quite, you know, with it. And so, so that's an identity. You are smart. And now my 4-year-old is trying to say a lot, am I the best at this? whatever. Something like that. Or am I really good at this? I don't know. And we have some idea it's coming a little bit from preschool already. And so we say to him something like, looks like you're having a lot of fun. You know, it looks like you're really putting a lot of, you know, good effort in there or something. We try to turn it away from an identity, the best or whatever. But anyway, most of us, you know, don't have the benefit of that research. And so, you know, when we grew up, so people get locked in to identities, the smartest, the dumbest, the, you know, whatever. And so it becomes oppressive for people. So part of the function of this insight meditation is the ability to look at these kinds of aspects of our life, deconstruct them, take them apart, see the nature of the clinging to them, and begin loosening up. It's a path towards freedom. The other side of meditation, the concentration practice, in a sense, focuses more on the subjective aspect of experience, how it is to meditate. Insight focuses on what you look at when you meditate. Concentration focuses on how you feel as you meditate, and how meditation shifts and change how you feel. And to explain this a little bit, if you have a meal and you fill yourself up, I think we say, you know, I'm really full, I don't have any space for anything anymore. I'm full. That's enough. Thank you. Someone tries, oh, please, even if it's really delicious, really, really good. If you're full enough, no thanks, it's enough. Or say that you're, if you haven't been around people much and you're lonely, then it's really nice sometimes to be around people. But you can be around people so much that you feel saturated. Enough already, people. I'm just so saturated. And we talk about that sometimes. I'm saturated with whatever. I'm saturated with work. Enough of this work. I need a vacation. Or enough of people. Or enough of something. Some people get saturated with television. Enough. My hope is they get saturated early. Really quick. And so we kind of feel full. And when we feel full, in a healthy way, we feel like we have enough, and we're not interested in holding on or grabbing or reaching out, thirsting, wanting something else. So part of the function of concentration practice, among its many functions, is to fill us up. So we feel full of things like happiness or well-being or calm or peacefulness, a sense of peace. And to kind of somehow suffuse or relax the places we feel a lack, we feel incomplete. The sense of incompletion, the feeling of being a kind of absence, not having enough, can be very deeply felt in the body, in the heart, in the mind. And it can lead to all kinds of suffering and all kinds of sometimes painful behavior. People sometimes are lonely and they head for the refrigerator or head for the local pharmacy or you know, had to, you know, do something that is maybe not so healthy, or to try to fill that sense of emptiness or loneliness that might be there. Or people feel like they're, you know, somehow inadequate in some way, not good enough. And so I'm not a good, you know, my 9-year-old son, you know, he has this little question of he's not quite good enough as a baseball player. So, you know, he feels, you know, they lost the game today. And so this feeling of kind of, you know, inadequacy, and you can feel it sometimes, you know, he's a great player and for his level, his age, but you can see a sense of inadequacy is there. So it's so easy to feel inadequacy, insufficiency, unworthiness. And sometimes it can be felt as a sense of lack. I'm not good enough, or I don't have enough. And if only I had X, Y, and Z, then I'd be really happy. If only we could meditate in a place where there's no train whistles. Then, you know, if I had a really silent meditation hall, then I would really be able to meditate well and get into deep concentration. If you felt really full with peace, full of happiness as you meditate, the sounds of the train or some distraction around you is not going to disturb you. Because sometimes when you feel a lack inside, an inadequacy inside, there's going to be a tendency to blame or resist or hold on to things of the world. That's interfering with my attempt to get my peace. Or that activity is going to make me happy or peaceful. And so there's a kind of sometimes this look externally to try to fill the emptiness in here. And part of what can happen with concentration practice, we start filling up. We start feeling fuller and fuller. So for example, if you start feeling a feeling of contentment, and that contentment spreads and becomes palpable inside of you, tangible, kind of gripping inside of you, kind of saturating inside of you, then if it's that strong, the contentment, then you know obviously you don't feel discontented. And if you don't feel discontented, then you're probably not going to behave in those kinds of ways that you behave when you feel discontented. You know, you're discontented with all kinds of things. Because, you know, the things of the world, you're focusing on those things always, right? The things of the world have to be a certain way to make me happy. Concentration practice can show you how to be happy without the things of the world being a certain way. It's kind of like this, a flame or a warmth or a something arises inside of you and spreads throughout from the inside, rather than somehow being satisfied from the outside. In Buddhism, this distinction is made by saying that the joy or the pleasure of meditation is non-sensual. It's not a joy or pleasure that comes through the five sense doors, your senses, but rather bubbles up inside. If you have a nice nap, went for a nice hike, had a nice nap, had a little picnic, woke up, you know, in a nice spring day under an oak tree someplace, and everything feels really peaceful, you might feel a deep sense of peaceful abiding throughout your being. And it isn't that necessarily that, you know, the warmth of the sun makes you feel happy. It isn't necessarily because you had a nice meal that makes you feel happy. There's a sense of harmony, inner peacefulness that seems to bubble up inside. So this is what can happen in meditation. There can be a joy, a pleasure that can arise that's not being stimulated by a massage or good food or by sex or by listening to good music or, you know, whatever. It's just kind of, as the system gets more and more harmonious, more settled, more relaxed, then this inner sense of well-being begins bubbling up. And I find it quite interesting and quite significant to sit down and meditation in other times and become aware of those places in my being, in my body, in my mind, in my heart, where I feel kind of a lack, where I feel kind of like I'm not quite connected to myself. Or a little bit disconnected, or feel a bit tense, or something. And sometimes I can feel it on my shoulders, sometimes in my stomach. And it just kind of, I don't feel kind of really settled. I feel sometimes a little hard, kind of sometimes a little brittle. And it's interesting then with the breath, in meditation, for example, to breathe into those areas, or to get settled in meditation, start feeling some calm, and letting the calm spread out into those areas, massage those areas with practice. And letting the sense of well-being in meditation kind of begin spreading into the places where there's a feeling of tension or a sense of lack or inadequacy, and begin softening and mellowing it. And slowly, if it goes well, then it begins to soften and mellow. The hardness that can be there, the brittleness, the discomfort that can be there begins to soften and relax. And this is very interesting because if you're trying to solve your life, when you feel some kind of lack or emptiness, and you're trying to solve it externally, it doesn't necessarily fill the inner emptiness. You can only do so much from the outside. But if you come from the inside, you can really get in there from the inside and reach out and touch and feel and relax and soften all these places that might feel empty. And what it means is that you don't have to figure out a great philosophy, a great story. You don't have to get the right relationships. You don't have to get the right job. You don't have to have the right living situation. You don't have to live in the right country. You don't have to even, it doesn't have to even be peaceful around you. You know. United States, in the index of world, what is it, global index of peace, they measured, using 24 criteria, which countries in the world were the most peaceful. And there was 121 countries they did this measurements for. And those are, so where do you think America, United States, fit in that list? Yeah, you read it. You shouldn't answer if you read the article. Oh, just good guess.
Norway.
Yeah, Norway was number one. Most peaceful. Norway was number one. And New Zealand was number two. And then I think Sweden and maybe Finland or Denmark were three and four. Slovenia was nine. And Canada was pretty good. And Iraq was 121. But the United States was 96. And I have a friend of mine who, when he teaches, he says, like this evening, he says, oh, right now, it's a little bit late now, but the sun now is setting for us. And the same sun is now rising over Iraq. And the idea being they're not so far away. You know, and so it might be nice for us here and comfortable here, but it's not comfortable for other people. So I say that because it's quite even in situations that are quite distressing externally, it's possible to settle oneself and have a sense of peace, well-being, that can bubble up and settle us from the inside. And I think for many people, they're always trying to look externally, fix something in order to get what they need. So part of the function of concentration practice is to do that. And it does it in a number of ways. One way it does it is by relaxing. The concentration practice is you need to be relaxed if you want to concentrate. You can't be concentrated in a tense way. You can get concentrated in a certain kind of way then, but it's not samadhi. It's not the Buddhist concentration. You have to be quite relaxed. And in fact, often the vehicle towards deep concentration is for many people is to relax, 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 soften, soften, soften. And as you get more relaxed in meditation, the body feels more and more kind of lighter, softer, often warmer as a result. That's one way. Another way is to not let the mind wander off into its discursive thoughts, into distractions. I think for most people, most of the time, the world of discursive thinking is not a pleasant place. It could be. Sometimes it is. It's a delightful place. In Norway, Norwegian, there's I was told once that there's a word, flira, which I was told means to smile for no reason, or to smile at your own thoughts. So, it's possible to have thoughts that, are delightful and wonderful. But I think many people find that their thoughts are not necessarily their best friends, that what they think about adds to the stress, adds to the worry of what's going on. So part of the concentration practice is learning to kind of settle and relax these discursive thoughts so they're not operating so strongly. And perhaps ultimately not operating at all. And in very deep concentration, there is no discursive thinking whatsoever. And that's, for people who live in discursive thinking, it's unimaginable that there could be such a thing. Why would you want such a thing? I think, therefore I am. And I am, therefore I think. And it's so intertwined, this idea of thinking and who I am. And I wouldn't exist if I don't think. But that is discursive thinking, this kind of louder, more kind of talking to ourselves kind of thing, can settle away. And it's really a wonderful thing. And part of what happens with a lot of discursive thinking, we're wrapped up in discursive thought, we actually get alienated from ourselves. We're not alienated from our thinking, but we're alienating from our body, from our feelings, and kind of this sense of being holistically connected here. So as the discursive thought quiets down, we have a greater opportunity to start feeling ourselves in a subjective way, feeling the inner sense of being alive, inner sense of presence, inner sense of aliveness, of vitality, inner sense of what's going on here. Another aspect that's very helpful with concentration practice is to really be in your body. And it's a little bit counterintuitive for people because you think concentration has to do with zeroing in the mind to focus on one point, something like that. But Buddhist samadhi has a lot to do with the body. The language for samadhi, the verbs used for concentration practice in Buddhism, are verbs of physical words like touching and feeling. We touch aspects of our mind. It's a tangible thing. It's not a mental thing, concentration, as much as it is a physical phenomenon. And to settle on our experience in a physical way, to feel our body. And as we feel our body and relax our body, then the tensions in our body begin to unravel. And as the tensions of the body unravel, the numbness that can be there because we're tense begins to soften as well. To be chronically tense is a way of kind of guaranteeing that parts of your body are going to go numb, going to be disconnected. If you're lost in discursive thought, you're disconnected. Concentration practice is a way of getting connected, more and more connected. Some people will say that concentration practice is an effort to unify everything that we are. It's a unification practice. It brings all of ourselves together. So it's not an attempt to exclude or deny or make yourself less. Concentration practice is a practice to make yourself more and more. Whereas insight practice is a practice to realize that you're not all these things. In a sense, make you less and less. Concentration practice is to make you more and more. You feel more full of well-being, of peace, kind of radiating out, kind of glowing from you. If you take these two forks, both, just by themselves, then at some point, the subject-object duality or distinction falls away. When you do insight meditation and just looking at the objects of experience, at some point you also take the attention and turn around and look at the mind that's doing the noticing. And you say, oh, there's concentration there now, or there is a thought, or there is mindfulness operating, or there is joy, or all these things going on, and you look at them as objects as well. And eventually, with very strong mindfulness practice, you realize that everything becomes an object of attention. And nothing, you realize in this world where everything becomes an object of attention, you realize nothing can be found to be the self. And everything you thought that was a subject of who I am, the subjective I, is not findable. And so the mind then eventually relaxes and relaxes and relaxes, and there's no subject-object duality anymore because there's no subject. Maybe you can't talk about an object anymore either then. But the falling away of subject-object happens by everything in a sense becoming a flow of impermanent objects that you become aware of. It can sound kind of dry. You're not there, but all this flow of impermanent objects. Generally, you don't get into that very deep mindfulness unless you're also very concentrated. And if you're concentrated, then you have a lot of joy. So it's really good. Yeah. In concentration practice, the subject becomes bigger and bigger. You get feeling this tremendous sense of flow or vibration or warmth or delight or joy or great peace or equanimity that somehow suffuses. The Buddha talked about it suffusing and saturating your whole body. This feelings that can be there. And the sense of the mind can feel quite expansive when you do strong concentration practice. Big, the body feels quite expansive and big. The sense of the boundaries of the body falls away. Sometimes people say they feel no experience of the body But even though they don't experience of their body, there's still a feeling of great presence or expansiveness or consciousness that somehow seems very big. And as that gets bigger and bigger, more and more still, the mind gets stiller and stiller and stiller. There's less and less activity of the mind to distract you or to keep you from this great feeling of unification. And because there's less and less activity of the mind, there's less and less selfing activity in the mind. There's less and less activity in the mind where you hold on and grip or attach or resist or afraid or angry or building up a sense of self. And the less and less is going on there. And then as you do this, eventually everything becomes, you know, in a sense, pure subject. You know, just pure subject. Rather than everything becoming pure objects, now it's all pure subject. And the mind is very, very still. And at some point, those are the two things. Right? So when people say that they've overcome the subject-object duality, sometimes what it means is they've gone to one or the other of those two extremes. They've kind of gone into everything's object, they become the object, or they become pure subject. When people get enlightened in Buddhism, then both fall away. It isn't that it's all pure object, it's not that it's pure subject, but it just all falls away. It all kind of drops away. And some people call that the ultimate experience of non-duality. When not only is there no subject-object distinction, because one part of the equation has fallen away, but both sides of the equation have fallen away completely. And you get a sense of that when you realize the mind has gotten very still, for example, in strong concentration practice. There's very little activity of the mind going on. So at some point, the last remnants of activity of the mind also settles itself, goes to peace. And when the last little kind of little activity of the mind goes to peace, then you experience this great peace that in Buddhism they call nirvana or enlightenment. When you take the route of mindfulness, which is a primary practice we do here, then there's a deep understanding of the things of this world. It gives you a lot of wisdom, a lot of understanding, a lot of street smarts. And it's transferable with you, those insights. You begin seeing the nature of all kinds of things and understand it. There's knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And you can, it's transferable. It's very useful. Whereas when you have deep concentration practice, it can be very healing. It can heal all kinds of traumas and all kinds of divisions within us. If you lose your concentration practice and you're not so concentrated, it's not portable then. You know, you don't necessarily you don't have any great insight, understanding that you can necessarily kind of then apply in different situations. Both are important. Both practices are important. Now, some teachers say that it's artificial to separate them out too much as two different meditation practices, but they can be held together. You can develop a lot of concentration while you're developing a lot of mindfulness. You can develop a lot of mindfulness while you develop a lot of concentration. And then you get best of both worlds. And it's probably the safest way to go, to develop practice in that kind of way. You don't choose one over the other. In both ways of practicing, your relationship to the world shifts and changes. In mindfulness practice, your relationship to the world changes because you have a new understanding of what the world is about. In mindfulness, your relationship to the world changes because you have a new relationship to yourself, in a sense. You feel so full, so content, that you know, the objects of the world have different meaning. And if you're starving, food has one meaning. If you're full, it has a different meaning. So if you're full of peace and full of well-being, the world will have a different meaning than if you're kind of feeling a sense of lack or scarcity. So to both understand the world we live in, the objects of the world, the things of the world, and to have a sense of abundance inside of you, spiritual abundance, to operate from a place of, to overcome any sense of inner scarcity in your life, but rather feel a sense of abundance. So no matter where you go, maybe you carry that abundance with you. And then if you're tempted by the things of the world, then you understand the things of the world well enough that you understand that your lasting and happiness, your well-being, cannot be found there. It's fine to pursue things in the world in a nice way, but if you count on the world too much, expecting the world to kind of solve big problems for you, big inner psychological problems, not only will it not work, it'll actually make the wound or the emptiness or the inadequacy feel stronger. So whether you do mindfulness practice or you do concentration practice or you do both, there becomes a very different relationship to the world and to your own happiness. And then with time, you begin appreciating your capacity to be happy from within. And as you discover that capacity and potential, then hopefully meditation practice will allow that potential to grow and develop. And from inside of you, there's a little furnace of joy that you carry with you everywhere you go. So I hope that makes sense. And we have a couple of minutes if someone wants some question or clarification. Yes, Matt. There's a mic right on you.
Gil, what's an example of a concentration meditation and what's an example of an insight meditation?
Well, I can give you the same answer for both, and then I'll give you different answers for two different kinds. So breath meditation can function both ways. And you can get very concentrated on the breath, and also you can have deep insight into the nature of the breath and also at the same time. Or you can take it two different routes. Breath can become primarily an insight practice where you start seeing the changing nature of the sensations of breathing. Or to become a pure concentration practice, if you at some point when you no longer are looking at the nature of the breathing, the characteristics of it, but you lock in, your mind locks in, fixates on one particular unchanging quality of the breath or aspect in a sense. So you're not really seeing the changing nature of things. So mindfulness practice, for example, is what we practice here usually, and so there's not a fixed commitment to any one object of attention. So it's sometimes if the body's feeling really strong sensations, you pay attention to the body. If the sounds are predominant, you pay attention to sound. If emotions are strong, you pay attention to emotions. And you're paying attention in such a way you're trying to understand the nature, the characteristics, the qualities. Really see it deeply what this really is. The Vipassana question is, what is this? Really get to see it well for what it is. Concentration practice can be concentration on the breath, it can be concentration on the mantra, concentration on the visualization. And it's generally something that that sooner or later is not changing. And the changing nature of a phenomenon becomes less and less important in concentration practice. What becomes important is the place where the mind can just rest. And the more fixed the object is, the more the mind can rest and not move there. And then as the concentration deepens, then this magic thing starts happening, that this inner well-being starts welling up, even if you don't even want it. This is kind of a silly story. I was in retreat, and there's a kind of a pattern by which people, a pattern of concentration meditation, where joy, or sometimes called rapture, occurs before happiness, a kind of deeper, sublime feeling of well-being. And if you feel the rapture really strong for the first time, it feels like it's pretty ultimate. But if you've had it a lot, it feels kind of old, and it's kind of energetic, and kind of tiring after a while. And so it's much better to kind of get into this happiness thing, this much more sublime, peaceful kind of happiness of well-being. So I knew that, and so I was doing walking meditation, and the joy part started coming up. And I knew there was something better than joy. So I tried to, keep that joy down, I was repressing, no, and I'm going for the better stuff. No joy, I'm going to hold it down, I'm going to repress it, And so then, because it was bubbling up, I didn't want it. Stay down. Go away. It's silly, right? And so I was doing walking meditation about 45 minutes, you know, so I don't know how long it was, half an hour. And I started getting a headache from that effort of keeping the joy down. And finally I said, this is ridiculous, when I noticed what I was doing. So then I just relaxed and let go, and the joy kind of welled up really strongly. And it lasted about 30 seconds before it settled away and I dropped into the happiness. You know, I needed to go through it, you know, and so that, you know, that was the gate. I didn't realize there was a gate to get to the happiness. So I hope the talk today was inspiring for you to do your meditation practice. It's a good thing to do, whatever it is, whatever type you're doing. So, thank you.